You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko kēs te tōku ingoa. Nō mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire Wharahina Monday. I'm your host, Caster, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Thomas. In Whaake Nei, coming up on the show, for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, I spoke to MP Simon Court about the second phase of the government's COVID-19 inquiry and the creation of MCERT, the Ministry of Cities, Environment, Regions and Transport. I also spoke to spokesperson for NZIE Te Reo Roa, the Union for Primary School Teachers, Liam Rutherford, about a recent dispute between the union and the government where individual employment agreements were offered to non-union teachers before collective bargaining finished. And I spoke to Director of Pūtahi Research, Daniel Collins, about a proposed data centre to be built in Southland and concerns around its potential water use. Thomas, what have you got for us today?
I spoke to Etu Union Director for Manufacturing and Food, Fino Dwai Kanwith, about Heinz Waddies closing four of its sites across the country and what can be done to protect workers from local producers shutting down. And I also talked to Public Service Association National Secretary Fleur Fitzsimons about the PSA calling on MPs to sign a pledge which promises to stop a bill that would cut holidays for thousands of workers.
He aha o whakaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pā, tuhi mai, text in on 5395, or wai mai rane, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Kaua e wareware e aheina koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō. Hei pakehere rokiroki mārunga i te pai, tukutuku o ererangi poho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more, as always, by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
On Tuesday last week, the findings were released from the second phase of the government's COVID-19 inquiry. The inquiry broadly found that the Labor government's approach to managing COVID-19 followed evidence, had strong public approval, and left multiple opportunities for future learnings. While the inquiry acknowledges spaces where the government could have made improvements, dispensations were made due to the unprecedented nature of the COVID pandemic, and the report generally indicates that the government handled the situation well, given the available information. Last year, the government announced plans to create MCERT, a new ministry for cities, environment, regions and transport. This ministry would merge the ministries for the environment, transport, housing and urban development, and the local government components of the Ministry for Internal Affairs. While the government says this change will increase efficiency and reduce bureaucratic bloat, critics say that the creation of a mega ministry could reduce the government's abilities to focus on any of its responsibilities individually. For our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, Simon Court, this week, I asked him about the second phase of the COVID-19 inquiry and about MCERT. Well, I wanted to start off today with the second phase of the government's COVID-19 inquiry. What are the ACT Party's key takeaways from this inquiry?
Well, the report the subsequent Royal Commission has delivered provides that broader scrutiny that Labor originally tried to avoid. Their first inquiry looked narrowly at the response itself, not the wider consequences for people's lives. And the problem was that a necessary and vital emergency response turned into a much wider program of longer lockdowns and massive spending, including for things that went well beyond any relationship to COVID response. I mean, for example, where I live in Auckland, they've just finished building a walking track around the harbour, Upper Harbour Te Aratu inlet there, which apparently was a shovel-ready fast-track project going back to 2020 or 2021. So, I mean, they were just shoveling money out the door with no relationship at all to the necessary and vital COVID emergency response.
A lot of the stuff discussed in the inquiry mentions the fact that the government was dealing with a first-of-its-kind event and had very little evidence and very little public health infrastructure to deal with the COVID-19 pandemic. Do you think that's being too harsh on the government, given that they were not prepared and there was very little precedent for how to respond to an event like this?
I think the emergency response and the time that it took to work out what the risk to New Zealand was the right thing to do. There's no question that in the first few weeks and months of the pandemic, everyone was feeling their way. But you know, unfortunately, they went far beyond that.
There's also what the ACT Party has been saying about vaccine mandates. The COVID-19 inquiry goes a bit into the public perception of the mandates. I'd like you to talk about that a bit. What is the ACT Party's perception of how the mandates were handled in Aotearoa?
Well, ACT said that mandating people to take a medical treatment is not fair and it's not reasonable. And that's why we advocated for if people who didn't want or feel that they could, for medical reasons, take the vaccine, they should have the opportunity to demonstrate through RAT testing or some other type of test that they were free from COVID before going. Was a fair and equitable way to deal with the fact that some employers, some workers were nervous about the risk of COVID coming into their workplace, but other workers justifiably and employers say, hey, we don't want to be subjected to a mandate to take what they felt was a potentially risky and novel medical treatment.
There's been some criticisms that the focus on the vaccine mandates has been a bit overblown, with a percentage mentioned in the inquiry, 74% of respondents found in a One News opinion poll in 2021 supported the mandates. Is it a bit, I mean, you know, we're 5 years on from that, is it still an important thing to be discussing?
Thousands of people were mandated out of their employment, including teachers, police officers, Defence Force personnel, medical staff. And, you know, you rightly point out that around a quarter of the population, when they were surveyed, said we don't agree with the mandates. Now, you don't tell a quarter of the population you're going to take the jab or you're not going to be allowed to work, come into your place of employment or education. You know, that is the actions of an authoritarian state. That's why ACT opposed it, and we said if there's a public health need, there must be another way to do this, which is, of course, to be able to use the RAT tests. But Labor banned the RAT tests, and people who had imported them so they could use them with their workforce to actually determine, you know, who had a clear and present risk of COVID. That's the time when, you know, you had to wait days to get a result from a PCR test. Labor banned them and said it's a criminal offence to use them. Now, you know, what the second inquiry has revealed, and what many of us knew at the time and were asking for at the time, is a much wider consideration of the costs and benefits of the type of policy choices that were made. And, you know, we didn't argue with the fact that the government of the day took some decisions to close New Zealand's borders and impose movement restrictions while they got to grips with the scale of the pandemic and the risk to public health. But some years later, it's really, really important that we understand all of the costs and all of the potential benefits that they thought they were trying to get, and understand what did it do. You know, people were locked out of their schools. I know many, many young people who were locked out of school because of lockdown, told to jump online and learn that way. They disengaged and they never returned to formal education. You know, how many people missed saying goodbye to loved ones in their dying days, and how many people, you know, missed seeing the birth of a new child into their family because they were unable to come to a hospital because of, you know, significant restrictions. But, you know, on balance, we might say, necessary in some cases, but definitely not in others. We have to learn because we're going to be faced with another pandemic, another biological threat to New Zealand. It's in our top five risks that Civil Defence and Emergency Management plans for, and we need to have learned these lessons.
Just before we move on, I want to make a quick clarification. You said that 74% supporting meant that a quarter were opposed. The poll found that there were 20% who opposed and 6% who didn't know. Just
well, again,
for our listeners
again,
there.
Let's not split hairs for the listeners. Let's acknowledge there's a large group of New Zealanders who said you shouldn't force me to take a novel medical treatment because I don't accept that the risks are fair to me, or I just don't accept to be told that I have to be injected with something in order to go to work or leave my house. That is not an unreasonable objection, and the reason the ACT Party exists is to say, look, it might not be popular, but we stand up for people's right to choose, your body, your choice, and that is one of ACT's core beliefs and core principles.
I wanted to move on to the government's decision to merge some ministries, creating the new Ministry for Cities, Environment, Regions and Transport, or MCIRT, merging the ministries for the Environment, Housing and Urban Development, Transport and the local government components of the Ministry for Internal Affairs. What's the rationale behind creating this new mega ministry?
This ministry is about getting the basics lined up in the background so that government can help projects and programs happen in housing, transport and local government instead of getting in the way, because right now there's just too many agencies, there's too much overlap, and that means there's not enough accountability. So this reform and restructure is about establishing a clearer system, faster decision making and less bureaucracy, so we can get planning, transport, housing, environment and local government all working together properly.
There's concerns that folding in environment with these other ministries might lessen the focus on environmental advice, concerns over climate change. How would you respond to that?
Well, disagree. This restructure is about culling the bureaucracy, and because too many agencies mean too much waste, too much duplication of effort, and too many excuses why stuff can't get done. This reform is intended to simplify and deliver a smaller and more effective government that actually focuses on results. And, you know, we're currently carrying out a resource management reform. I have the role of Undersecretary for Resource Management Reform and delegated with Chris Bishop, delivering planning and a natural environment bills to improve our system. It's going to mean a much reduced scope of things for councils to do. It's going to mean that, you know, the effects that we're required to consider currently, you know, de minimis or less than minor effects, councils are only going to have to consider actual effects on the environment and people. And the intention is that we speed up development. We know how to manage the environment well in so many different ways, and of course there's things that we still want to improve. But we don't need four separate ministries doing transport, housing, planning and environment, all offering different advice when we know what the answers are. We've just got to simplify the system, get it operational, and make sure councils are supported to through the transition so they can start delivering some of these benefits to Kiwis that, yeah, we know are long overdue.
With this ministry, the ministries that are coming into it are some of our most important ministries, right? Environment, Housing and Urban Development, Transport and Internal Affairs. These are very important ministries that affect across the nation. Why are we making cuts to these ministries in the interest of efficiency as opposed to maybe some other ministries with less operational needs and providing less services, such as, you know, the Ministry for Regulation, the Ministry for the South Island? There's many ministries that provide less than these ministries. Why make cuts here as opposed to there?
Because the ministries that we are restructuring each have their own multi-layered executive and chief executives. We don't need four of them. We can use one management layer to manage the outcomes from this new entity. So that's significant saving. And, you know, I'll just reiterate, for too long, both central government and local government, which this ministry will administer, have said no by default to development. And what this ministry is doing, it's setting the government side up to say yes to building, yes to infrastructure, yes to growth. You know, cutting duplication and waste, making government simpler and more accountable, having one chief executive responsible for the outcomes we want in transport, housing, from planning and the environment and the local government function. That makes sense to most people. And I think you're going to see the results much quicker from the reforms we're putting in place around infrastructure funding and financing, resource management reform, and improving the efficiency of local government if you've got one agency and one chief executive responsible for delivering it.
That was the ACT Party's Simon Court speaking to me about the second phase of the government's COVID-19 inquiry and the MCIRT ministry merger.
That was Simon Court from the ACT Party.
So it's a very odd time to be alive, as they say.
The Wire.
Last week, Heinz Waddies announced plans to close its factories in Auckland, Christchurch and Dunedin and cease packing at its frozen lines in Hastings. This will leave 350 workers without jobs in an already tough job market. Additionally, many seasonal employees who have worked in factories for decades could be left redundant without financial compensation. Concerns have been raised about potential ripple effects the closures will have on the economy, with 220 growers in the Canterbury region alone relying on supplying the Christchurch factory. To discuss the consequences of these decisions, and what more the government could be doing to protect workers and local New Zealand production, I talked to Etu Union Director for Manufacturing and Food, Finn O'Dwyer-Cunliffe. Now, for our listeners who aren't caught up with this Heinz Waddies closure situation, could you give some context and tell us how big the impact will be on workers?
Yeah, so they have proposed to close operations in four sites in Auckland, Hastings, Dunedin and Christchurch. It's a proposal to scrap 350 jobs, so it's pretty massive. There's a big impact, a wider impact as well on the farming and growing community, those working in crops in the arable sector, particularly down in the South Island. So the impact of this does go pretty wide. It's pretty devastating for the communities and families involved, and many of the workers have been working at these factories for several decades.
As you say, some of those 350 workers have been at Waddies for decades, and they're now going to be left scrambling to find a job in quite a grim job market. Could you tell us, you know, how big a financial impact it will be for them and how they can be supported?
It will be a huge impact. Yeah, you've got one of our delegates was telling us she hasn't interviewed for a job since 1979. That's how long they've been working there. And these are the kind of roles where people are, the workers are a family, and we're all in it together across these sites. A huge impact to lose your job when you've been there for a while and you have few other options, particularly in a situation, as you say, where we've got decade-high unemployment and a huge number of people seeking work and income support. So we'll support our members the best that we can. We do have good redundancy provisions because the union has fought hard over many years to preserve those across these sites. So that is a shred of comfort, but still difficult for people to be facing a loss of income and a loss of work at this stage of their careers.
And with those redundancy compensation, it's good for the workers who are full-time, but how about those seasonal workers who won't potentially see any financial compensation?
Well, we're hopeful that they will. We've been talking to the company about that issue. We flagged it up straight away as a major concern, not only for the directly affected seasonal workers, but also for their colleagues, other workers who are very concerned about, them potentially missing out on those entitlements. We've had some positive indications from Waddies that they will be paying redundancy for seasonal workers as well. So we really hope that they stick to that. We know that Kraft Heinz can certainly afford it. So we expect them to come forward with the resources to make that happen.
You also talked about of how this impacts suppliers to the factories. How worrying is this for a ripple effect that it could potentially have on the New Zealand economy?
Yeah, it's really worrying, and it's continuing a trend, really, of companies that are ultimately owned by very wealthy people, whether they're New Zealand businessmen or whether they are wholly owned or part-owned overseas, of just closing their doors when it's convenient for them and they feel that the costs of operating in New Zealand aren't worth it. The way that Kraft Heinz has set up, they're just able to pull out and focus on producing in probably lower cost countries elsewhere, but that just has an impact on the workers here and growers here who supply them. We do really worry for those growers and those communities that have been producing, you know, essential products for New Zealand consumers, certainly in the case of frozen vegetables, for years and years, that work will just be outsourced elsewhere. We shouldn't be in that position. These are iconic Kiwi brands that we're talking about, and something needs to change in our economic system to address that.
Talking about that pattern of closure, in 2025, companies going into liquidation in New Zealand hit a 15-year high. What do you think is behind the trend, and what can the government do more to support these businesses and their workers?
Well, one of the things behind the trend is just a lack of regulation, because when New Zealand companies, like Wadis, are bought up by overseas conglomerates, then there's just less in it for them. There's less commitment for that overseas decision maker to be concerned about the impact on the local economy here in New Zealand, which is just one of many, many countries in which they're operating in. The other thing that I would say is that these companies have been hit by higher costs, as we all have. You know, the cost of producing and, supply chain issues are real, particularly around energy. And again, there's been a real lack of urgency from the government in particular to intervene in that space. And because we're not in a situation where we have the right number of renewable options available to us, we're hit by situations like what we're seeing in Iran at the moment. That has a flow-on effect to production lines and costs for manufacturers, and makes it unfortunately too easy for people to pull out. So we really need to see, as I said, a new approach to tackling spiralling costs for manufacturers and the flow-on effect that that has for workers.
That was Etu Union Director for Manufacturing and Food, Fino Dwyer Cunliffe, speaking to me about the Heinz Wadis factory closures and their impact on workers.
We'll be right back after this short break. Text in your thoughts, 53995. You're listening to The Wire on 95 BFM.
Garth! Garth! Where's your hat? No hat, no play.
I don't have one, sir.
Then go on and pick a hat from Lost Property.
Oh, sir, those hats all have nits.
It's nits or melanoma, Garth.
It's a no hat, no play summer. So it's lucky 95BFM have you sorted with sweet merch for your noggins. Choose from four designs, two classic cap designs, one cord design, and a bucket hat. Pre-order yours now from twotonesmerch.co.nz.
I believe in, like, the solar system. I believe in space. I really do believe in space.
Spaced Out. Josh Aoraki from Auckland Stardome Observatory and Planetarium talks everything spacey on Spaced Out. 4:40 every other Tuesday.
The world-famous True School hip-hop show.
Thursday nights, take a deep dive into all things hip-hop with BFM's True School, checking in on current and historical flows, beats, and grooves, both local and international. A Radio B institution spanning decades of solid cuts, and the one show to know.
We like the breeze, float straight out of our lids.
True School hip-hop show.
Keeping you clued in on what's fronting in the world of hip-hop.
True School hip-hop show.
Who you calling a bitch?
Thursdays from 9 to 11 p.m. with Get Ban, Luz, Max, Barry, and Eve Love in the area.
On 95 BFM.
At this radio station, we do our utmost to abide by the Broadcasting Standards Authority and their rules and guidelines. If you seriously think we've crossed the line on air, give us a call on 309 4831 within 20 working days of the broadcast date and tell us about it. We'll be able to help you out and tell you the procedure if you wish to make a formal complaint to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Fuck knuckles, cock and piss. Balls. Thank you.
Sure.
my mind for a kiss. Yeah, I guess that I'm the type to make obsessive lists of all the reasons you should fall in love the way I did. I could be crazy or I could be right that this is it.
Welcome back to The Wire. That was Cats by Mitski and My Bad by Rita May.
Is it too late in the process, though, to change that?
Nothing's too late, bro. Everything's made up in politics.
The Wire. The government is offering pay increases to non-union affiliated primary school teachers in advance of the collective agreement with those belonging to the primary teachers' union, NZEI Te Reo Roa. This circumvents the president of settling the union agreement first, which the union says undercuts their negotiation process. The union is currently looking for increased financial and staffing support from the government as workloads increase with both curriculum changes and an ever-rising number of teachers moving over to Australia. To discuss the negotiations and the issues that primary school teachers are facing, I spoke to NZEI spokesperson Liam Rutherford. The government is offering a new individual employment agreement to some non-union teachers. Is this undercutting NZEI in any way?
This is a serious breach of good faith from the government. For decades, we have had practice of non-union teachers receiving the terms and conditions of the collective agreement after it's been settled. This move has brought about a lot of anger and frustration from teachers, because it's looking to divide and conquer. What it's going to mean is that within a staff room, you're going to have teachers getting paid different amounts. And teaching by its nature is a rather collegial profession. And so we're just really disappointed with the move that the government has done, particularly given our current negotiations for the collective agreement are at such a delicate stage.
What is NZEI looking to get out of the negotiations at the present?
There is a small number of very important issues that are currently driving primary teachers right now. The first one is around being valued for the work that they do. And they're talking lots about how is it that we kind of attract and retain people into the teaching profession. Certainly there's lots of talk around the advantages of moving over to Australia right now. The second one is around the kind of lack of support for students with learning needs. This is something that has been coming up consistently for teachers because a child's learning conditions or a teacher's working conditions. And so they want to make sure that students are getting what they should out of an education system, and currently it's falling short, which tends to add more pressure onto other students and teachers alike.
The government's made a big show of making improvements to the education system, making changes to get better outcomes. Is this something that we're seeing reflected in the government's approach to negotiating with primary teachers?
I think this is some of the frustration that teachers feel, because they hear stories about the government bragging about X number of million dollars being put into learning support. But the reality is that that's not making a tangible difference on the ground. And so that frustration comes from politicians patting each other on the back because they've managed to get something into the budget. But teachers are much more motivated by whether or not a kid's got the support and the resources that they need to be successful. And that's where we just see a huge gap between a government being really proud of themselves and teachers wanting kids to have the resourcing that they need.
Yeah, and so if we're looking in the short term, obviously there's the agreement that we're looking to get resolved, but also in the long term, what kinds of things would NZDI be looking to the current government or to future governments, obviously in its election year, to see what improvements could be made in the education system?
Yeah, look, that's in some ways a really complex question, but also a real simple one. Our kids do need a diverse range of supports to be successful in classrooms. But if you go and ask teachers what's actually going to make a tangible difference, they're talking about really basic things like teacher aides in a classroom. This is an extra pair of hands to help with the running and the management of classes. But it also frees the classroom teacher up to be able to give one-on-one support time to those students that need a little bit more. And so while it's not a perfect solution, it's definitely one that would make a tangible difference and one that we're really keen to push the government on.
And you also mentioned that many teachers are leaving to Australia. Teachers are one of the key industries that Australian recruiters are targeting from New Zealand. What are the schools and the Australian government doing that's better than what teachers are seeing here?
Oh, to be really blunt, lots of our young teachers who have been in the profession for kind of 3 or 4 years now are looking at things like pay rates and the type of life that they want to lead. And so they're heading off to Australia because they can earn $20,000, $30,000, sometimes $40,000 more for doing a comparable job. And if you're a young person that doesn't necessarily have a family yet, that starts to look really appealing. Which is why teachers are really keen to make sure that value is one of the things that comes out of this round of collective agreement negotiations. And you'd like to think that the government will be really motivated for something similar as well, given we need to make sure that we're holding on to our experienced teachers. We can't just be an education system that brings a new teacher in for a couple of years and then waves them off from the airport.
That was NZEI spokesperson Liam Rutherford speaking to me about negotiations between the union and the government and the things teachers would like to see going forward.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Last Thursday, the Employment Leave Bill, which aims to replace the Holidays Act, passed its first reading in Parliament. The bill will reform annual and sick leave calculation, changing from a lump sum system to an hourly calculation scheme. While New Zealand Workplace Relations and Safety Minister, Brooke Van Velden, claimed the bill was meant to simplify leave calculations, criticisms of the bill's other potential impacts have emerged. Those who work irregular hours will receive less leave. It has been proposed a full day in lieu won't be provided for people working shorter shifts on public holidays, and leave for people on ACC compensation would be cut. In response, the Public Service Association has called on MPs to sign a pledge to oppose the law change and ensure workers aren't left worse off. To explain this pledge and why the PSA opposes the changes in the bill, I talked to PSA National Secretary Fleur Fitzsimons. For our listeners who may be unaware, can you explain what this pledge the PSA wants MPs to sign is and why it's so important?
We're really asking every single member of New Zealand's Parliament to sign a pledge that they will not make the lives of workers worse when it comes to annual leave, when it comes to sick leave and holiday pay. And we're doing this because we believe that no Member of Parliament comes to Wellington to do their job to make the lives of people worse. But actually, that's what Brooke Van Velden's changes to the Holidays Act do. They make it more difficult for people to be adequately compensated when they work on a public holiday, when they do irregular hours, or when they're paid in an irregular way. All of those people will be worse off as a result of what Brooke Van Velden wants to do to the Holidays Act. And we're really asking every single MP to say, I will not vote for something that makes people worse off. And that's why we're asking every party and every Member of Parliament to sign this pledge.
Talking about Brooke Van Velden, she's claimed that this bill is to bring simplicity and logic to employment leave calculation. Do you think this move to hourly calculations actually does make it more simple than the original lump sum system?
It certainly doesn't make it more simple. You just have to look at the Act. It is a complex web, but it is deliberately designed to encourage casualisation, to enable employers to employ people more cheaply, and to undermine the concept of public holidays. A worker who works on a public holiday at present, no matter how many hours they do, gets a day in lieu. And that's a fundamental principle. It recognises that public holidays are important. Everybody who is able to be off work is off work. It is a designed in time for people to spend time with their families. Brooke Van Belden is saying, no, we're not going to compensate you in the same way as we do now for working on a public holiday. You won't get a day in lieu. And there's a whole raft of other changes which are quite problematic and do take workers backwards. And that is a constant from this minister. She's making the lives of workers harder and the cost on employers lower.
Touching on some of those impacts, could you tell us how this bill may potentially have a larger impact on part-time workers specifically?
Yeah, there's quite an impact on workers who do additional hours or workers with irregular pay. So if we start with workers who additional hours, they will only accrue leave on their contracted hours. So that's the hours in the employment agreement that they're required to work. Any additional hours don't accrue leave. They're paid with an additional 12.5% loading. So that's a reduction right there. At the moment, those hours are calculated. They look at what's actually been worked, what's actually been paid. So that will result in less ability for those people to take leave because they'll have less of it. Workers with irregular pay, so people who get various allowances or they work in different ways over time, will only receive the allowances that they get regularly, so fixed allowances, when it comes to how they're paid for their leave. They will be paid not looking at what's actually happened to them prior to when they're taking their leave, but only those fixed allowances. So for people who work in an irregular way and have irregular pay, when they take leave, they will be paid less. Workers also won't accrue annual leave on or sick leave while they're on ACC. Now, that currently is the case, and we think that should continue. And there's a whole range of other situations where people who work part-time accrue sick leave in a way that reflects their working pattern. And so they actually get the proper entitlement to 10 days leave. Under these changes, again, that will not apply and people will have less ability to take that important time off when they're sick. So it's an attack from all sorts of angles and we're really worried about the impact it will have on those workers who are working on their public holidays, who do irregular hours, who do additional hours, who need to access that sick leave. But we're also worried about the message it sends to employers about the approach they should take to employment. So we think this will encourage more casualisation. And when you look at it with the other changes that Brooke Van Belden's made to pay equity, the miserable increases to the minimum wage, the changes to contractor arrangements which enable employers to simply deem a person a contractor, these combined mean working people in New Zealand are in a very weak position, a precarious position, face insecure employment. And look, before Brooke got hold of all of this, we were already operating from a low base. Working people had few rights to begin with, and the situation has just got so much worse because of the ACT Party.
You mentioned there the pay equity changes. You've made comments in the past that this bill is the latest war on women from the government. Could you explain and touch on how legislation like this can impact women specifically in the workforce?
Yeah, women are more likely to work part-time. They're also more likely to work irregular hours. So what happens is when these provisions come in, they disproportionately impact on women. And we have described Brooke Van Velden's approach to industrial relations as a war on women. And you have to look at it in the context of what she did to pay equity. She cancelled claims, she gutted the Equal Pay Act overnight without any prior signalling before the election and without even allowing New Zealand women to be heard by the Select Committee. So if you look what she's doing to the holidays, if you look what she's doing to sick leave, if you look what she's doing to part-time workers and remember what she's already done to pay equity, it is a war on women. It's an attack on working women in this country who actually need to see much greater flexibility, much greater ability to enable them to be able to perform important work looking after children or looking after elderly relatives. But also this will impact on men as well, because some men, and increasingly it is the case, are picking up caring responsibilities and take that very seriously, and that is welcome. But all of these attacks undermine the ability for men to do this work and the ability for women to do it. So it's a real attack on working people across the board all over New Zealand.
That was Public Service Association National Secretary Fleur Fitzsimons speaking to me about the Employment Leave Bill and why the PSA is calling for MPs to sign a pledge against it.
We'll be right back. This is Sunday Morning by the Velvet Underground.
It's just a restless feeling by my side. Early dawning, Sunday morning. It's just the wasted years so close behind. Watch out, the world's behind. There's always someone around you who will call. It's nothing at all. Sunday morning, and I'm falling. I've got a feeling I don't want to know. I'm not as
Yeah, let's rock and roll, man.
The Wire. Welcome back to The Wire. That was Besties by Black Country New Road.
And I wish some of your dozy mates in the media had got a fix on their job and started being reporters and journalists, not editorialists and analysts, which they're not qualified to do. Prison company accepted, of course.
The Wire. Last week, resource consents were approved for a $3.5 billion AI centre to be constructed near Invercargill. While most of the commentary around the data centre is discussing how it could benefit New Zealand's economy or connectivity, few are discussing the potential environmental ramifications. While the consent applications aren't public, data centres overseas have been known to have varying degrees of environmental impact, including pulling drinking water out of communities and farmlands and subsequently creating droughts and increasing temperatures. To evaluate how a data centre could operate in New Zealand, I spoke to Director of Pūtahi Research, a consulting firm specialising in water and climate resilience, Daniel Collins. We've seen announcements about a data centre opening in Southland. Overseas, while data centres have been known to bring some economic and connectivity benefits, there are also some concerns around how they use water. How do data centres use water, and is that something that we should be concerned about here?
Sure. So you're right, data centres do use water, and they can use a lot of water. Mainly they use it in two ways. To cool the equipment, computers can get very hot when they're running intensely. But they can also use water, certainly in New Zealand, because of the electricity they use here is mostly generated by hydropower.
And when we're considering how the water usage would compare to our local infrastructure, do we have the water resources necessary to provide for a data centre, or is there more infrastructure that needs to be put in place?
That's a good question. I wouldn't be able to answer all of that. I do know that the aquifer that the water would come from for the data centre has low demand, so that's something. And apparently, the regional council down there, Environment Southland, has given a thumbs up for the water take. But what that really means, it's hard to say. I think the take is about 7 litres per second, which is about 220 million litres per year. Sounds like a big number. It probably is. It is. But what the implications for that are, it's hard to say.
And what happens to this water after it's been used by the AI data centre?
Sure. Now, I can't say as an expert how they will dispose of the wastewater, and there will be plenty to dispose of. It will be hotter than usual. They'll have to treat. They'll probably have to treat it in some way. They may try and get it to infiltrate back into the ground, but then there's that raises a red flag about a neighbouring wetland, and the hydrology may change, and what will effect that will have on the ecology. I do not know, but it's an important question.
And there's also concerns about our national electricity infrastructure, because data centres, as you mentioned, use a lot of power. Would creating a data centre down in Southland, could it divert power away from our city centres, which are using quite a lot of electricity already?
Well, it probably would. This gets to on the verges of my expertise. But sure, there's a finite resource, and if someone uses it, someone else can't. It is going to be also a big question in terms of our dry year problem, which has probably been discussed about recently regarding the energy proposals in Taranaki. The data centre is probably going to need the water. The electricity, rather, continually to run the centre. But what happens in a dry year when the hydro lakes are low, and in winter when electricity demand is high, it's an important question.
And because most of the plans around how this data centre will be constructed and how it will interact with the local infrastructure, these plans haven't come out yet, so a lot of this will be speculation. But do you imagine it will have a significant effect on Southland's electricity infrastructure, water infrastructure, and potentially on people living there?
It's hard to know. Like I said, the aquifer that they'll be taking water from currently has low allocation. So that's a good start. And Southland is wetter than other regions, so that's also a good start. But again, we're just talking about water. There are other aspects too. Electricity is basically national, so it's being close to a hydropower station isn't really a big deal. In terms of other water users, there could be an issue if they pump up water deep from deep underground and dispose of it in shallow. That could well rise the water level of the wetland. Water determines a lot of the ecology in wetlands, so you can expect a change there for competing uses. But also, I realised that in December last year, parts of Southland had water restrictions. So even though in some times of year maybe there's low water allocation, there can still be water shortages. So it's, again, another question that I don't have an answer to.
Did you have anything else you wanted to add?
Well, in relation to the water and the electricity, there's another thought perhaps people should think about is social license. We haven't thought about much about whether or not we want data centres in New Zealand so much. Social license comes up in terms of, say, water bottling or irrigation for dairy. Both of those have enough social license to go ahead, but it could well be that because the computations for the data centre are going to be sent overseas to Australia, I believe. There's the question about whether people want this type of facility in New Zealand.
That was Daniel Collins, the director of Pūtahi Research, a consulting firm specialising in water and climate resilience, speaking to me about how an AI data centre could operate in New Zealand after resource consents were approved for one in Southland.
That was The Wire.
Ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rahina Monday. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. The ACT Party Simon Court, Air 2 Union Director Finn O'Dwyer Cunliffe, NZEI Spokesperson Liam Rutherford, Public Service Association National Secretary Fleur Fitzsimmons, and Director of Pūtahi Research Daniel Collins. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1-4 with Penny.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.